Thanks for joining us. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is on a cruise with NPR listeners. There were anti-government protests in Iran this week on the 30th anniversary of the hostage crisis. Hamid Karzai was declared winner of the disputed presidential election in Afghanistan, but British Prime Minister Gordon Brown delivered a strong warning about corruption there. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas announced he's not running for re-election. Joining me to discuss these and, of course, other international news stories, James Kitfield. He is senior correspondent with National Journal magazine. Farah Stockman is foreign affairs reporter with the Boston Globe. And Paul Richter is also here. He is the diplomatic correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. All of you, thank you so much for joining me.
Good to be here.
We'll be opening the phones in just a while. 1-800-433-8850 is the number here. And, of course, do send us those emails with comments and questions. We love your questions, to drshow@wmu.org. Let's start with events in Iran, James Kitfield. Wednesday, of course, marked the 30th anniversary of the Iranian hostage crisis. The rally, the anti-American rally, was a little different this year.
Yeah, one block you have in front of the embassy, death to America, and big crowds sort of gathering and trying to, the sort of supporters of the regime, if you will. And a block and a half away, you have opponents of the regime saying death to the dictator. So it was, shows very clearly that these divides that we all saw during the summer elections that happened with the protests and the violent crackdown on the protests and then the show trials. You know, the question was, did that have legs? Was that going to continue? Was the divide going to be something that persists? And I think it's pretty clear that this divide is persisting. And what that does is make it complicates a lot of Obama's outreach to Iran, because as long as it feels sort of vulnerable internally, it's very hard to get a very coherent answer to a lot of questions like, will they honor this deal they made at the UN some weeks ago to ship their uranium out for further enrichment in Russia and France? They seem to be backing away from that now. The Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini had a very virulent anti-American speech where he basically rejected Obama's outreach. So this complicates America's sort of very sort of tight, schedule-driven attempt to get this issue of the Iranian nuclear program on the international agenda.
Farah Stockman, tell us a little bit more about Ayatollah Khomeini's speech on Tuesday.
Well, I think he said that he was talking about the United States being a superpower that will it always has a dagger when it behind its back when it's smiling, and I think he was basically defending himself from allegations from hardliners in Iran that the Iranian government is sitting down and speaking with the great Satan. So I think it complicates the Iranian government's position as well, because on the one hand, they want to go after these democracy activists in Iran and say, hey, you guys are puppets of the Americans. But on the other hand, they're sitting down and negotiating with the United States. And so one of the things that the Iranian government has used to consolidate its power and create unity in Iran has been, you know, being against the United States. It's a big part of their identity. And so I think they're going through a lot of troubles right now deciding who they are anymore after negotiating with the United States.
So, Paul Richter, if you're sitting in the White House trying to determine Iran policy at the moment and you're looking at these incredibly strong opposing forces, what are you thinking?
Well,
apart from I wish this wasn't my job.
It is a complicated one for the White House. President Obama put out a statement in which he spoke of the 30 years of mistrust and discord between the two countries, but he also had to say that the U.S. is eager for better relations with Iran. That wasn't the message that the protesters on the streets of Iran wanted to hear particularly. In fact, they were chanting something along the lines of, Obama, you're either with us or you're against us.
And even though that they were chanting that, even though I think that the only officially sanctioned slogan during those protests was Death to America this week.
Yes.
And yet somehow the protesters took it on to their own accord. And clearly that group of people who are still very disgruntled with the elections, as you said, are not going to be going anywhere. James, let's move on to the Middle East peace process. I don't know actually if you can even call it that at the moment. News that the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, has announced that he will not run. Having called these elections for January, he's now said he's not going to run in them. Why?
Well, he's very disappointed in this deadlock they had. He thought the administration, he had a commitment from the Obama administration to really crack down on Israel about settlements. You had the unfortunate situation where Secretary Clinton went over to the region, stood side by side with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and kind of gushed about how unprecedented his offer was to freeze new construction but not existing natural growth. It gets into sort of the weeds of what is and what is not a settlement and what is expansion of a settlement. So that was one thing. The other thing was, you know, we convinced that there was this very critical UN report, the Goldstone report, that said both Hamas and the Israeli government were guilty of war crimes in the war in Gaza earlier this year. And that was going to come up before the UN. The U.S. Basically convinced Abbas to sort of not promote that coming up before the UN, to sort of back away from a very divisive issue. He did that and caught hell at home. And he's facing elections at a time. He's very unpopular for that reason. So he seems he's being squeezed between a rock and a hard place between his domestic public opinion and what we're trying to do and get him to join direct negotiations. So he's very upset. The Arabs are very upset. So Clinton's going back to the Middle East to sort of restate the American position that these settlements are illegitimate. But right now, I would say from her trip in the last week, you know, Pakistan, I think there were some positive things. But from the Middle East, it was really a bad news story.
OK, let's talk a little bit more about Clinton's trip in just a minute. I want to get back to Abbas. Doesn't it mean, Paul Richter, that if you have some sort of succession battle going on in Fatah, that's going to play into the hands of Hamas? Or is that too simplistic a reading of this?
Yes, it's definitely a problem. From the American point of view, there just aren't that many alternatives to Abbas. There's Barghouti, but he's in jail. There's Dahlan, but he's in bad odor among the Palestinians for having he is accused of having botched the defense of Gaza in 2006. So there just aren't that many alternatives. This means...
And the State Department actually has come out quite forcefully this week. I noticed yesterday on Thursday coming out in favor of Abbas and saying that he's a very important player in the whole process, clearly, as you say, trying to boost him.
Yes, they're trying to boost him. Abbas has threatened to quit before. And yesterday, people in the Middle East and U.S. officials were not sure exactly, you know, how much of this is a threat.
It was one of my first questions, whether pulling out really meant pulling out.
Yes. It's unfortunate for Secretary Clinton that he's saying, look, I've got to quit because the Americans promised us they would stand firm on this settlement freeze, and now Secretary Clinton has backed away from it. So it's uncomfortable for her.
Okay. Farah, let's talk a little bit about the Secretary's comments, exactly what she said, because she said two different things. She did say also in public in one speech that the settlements were illegal and that they did have to be frozen, and then she said that she supported Benjamin Netanyahu's freeze on the current settlement building. Yeah. It was a confused message. It clearly got interpreted by the Palestinians as the Americans rowing back on the fact the settlements had to be dismantled and frozen.
I think one of the problems is that the message about welcoming the Israeli proposal came first. It came at the beginning of her trip, and so it got the Arab leaders and the Palestinians in an uproar. And then when she was in Morocco and later in Egypt, she qualified those statements and said, "Look, it still doesn't meet what the United States wants, which is a total halt to settlements, but we think it's a good start for negotiations. Let's just start negotiations." But clearly it's backpedaling. I remember in the summer, the State Department was saying, you know, no more settlements, including natural growth. They were very strong. They were very strong in their statements, but they didn't, when the Israelis said, no, we're not going to agree with you, they didn't have a follow-up. And so a lot of people are saying, look, if you're going to make that demand, you should have backed it up with some kind of spine. You should have had some kind of proposal for how you should have been willing to go the extra mile to actually press the Israelis. And so what they really did was raise the hopes and the expectations in the Arab world that the Americans were finally going to do something about settlements. And that hope has been dashed when they hear Hillary saying, okay, let's go ahead with negotiations, even though the Israelis haven't agreed to what you've said.
James, is it too political to wonder whether Hillary Clinton wasn't there playing good cop to what is perceived, certainly amongst Israelis, as Obama's bad cop? You have to remember that Barack Obama's approval ratings are, what, something like 4% in Israel at the moment? Was Hillary Clinton, do you think this... her message was coming direct from the White House to give the Israelis the the sense that they had a friend still that they could deal with in Washington, or is that all too Machiavellian?
Well, I actually think that, you know, Farr is right, that they'd hope to get them back in negotiations with the Israelis saying no more settlement construction. That didn't happen. So their fallback position is, let's get them into talks. Let's get them into talks. And Obama has said they want final issue talks. That's the last thing Netanyahu wants. He doesn't want to get into any talks about final status issues. So this gives him an excuse. So they're basically being stiff-armed by the Israelis. And, you know, anyone who's reported on this knows and can sympathize with Secretary Clinton about trying to straddle this very, very difficult position where you're trying to be a mediator and an interlocutor at one hand, but Israel's best friend in the world on the other. It's very difficult to do. However, I question why, if you don't have a deal to get them to the table, why lead with your chin and send her out there? That's the kind of thing that George Mitchell should be doing, I think. If, you know, until you get a deal in place, that's when you bring in the heavy guns to seal the deal. This clearly seems to me that there's no chance that that Abbas and Netanyahu are ready to sit down and talk about final status issues. This thing is really kind of deadlocked. And until it gets undeadlocked, I don't know why they're leading with Secretary Clinton.
Okay, we're going to be going to a break in just a minute. Before we do, Paul, I want to – Clinton, of course, was in Pakistan before she was in the Middle East. How did that trip go?
Well, she did a brave thing in Pakistan. She went on and basically took all the abuse that the Pakistani news media and college students could heap on her. And it's socially acceptable in Pakistan, let's say, to be pretty critical of the U.S. So she took a lot of beating there for a few days. It must have reminded her of the campaign. And she was patient. I think at a few moments it looked like she was losing her temper a bit. But the theory of the State Department is that, you know, we don't want to appear to be running away from this.
Okay, she gave a few beatings of her own as well, and we'll get back to that in just a minute. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us for the news roundup. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. You've joined the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. I've got James Kitfield from the National Journal here. Farah Stockman is here from the Boston Globe. And Paul Richter is also with me from the Los Angeles Times. We'll be taking your calls with questions and comments for our panel. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. Of course, you can also send us emails. drshow@wmu.org is the email address. Just before we went to break, Paul, you were talking about the Secretary of State's trip to Pakistan. She took a fair amount of beatings in those town hall meetings, but she was also pretty tough herself, wasn't she?
Yes, she dished some out as well. At one point, she said of the Pakistani government that it seems that they haven't done all they could to go after al-Qaeda, which seemingly has been had senior people in Pakistan since 2002. That caused a bit of a stir. Usually the administration presses the Pakistanis to go after the Taliban, but doesn't focus particularly on al-Qaeda because they're such a shadowy and difficult to track down group. So there was quite a reaction to that.
Okay, let's move on to Afghanistan, staying in that area of the world. Farah Stockman, on Monday, of course, Hamid Karzai was officially declared the winner of those disputed elections. Abdullah, his main rival, pulled out of the process. Where does this leave U.S. relations, particularly relations with Kabul at the moment?
I think in a tough position. A lot of people hoped Abdullah would go quietly and that he would just bow out. In fact, he made a pretty strong statement about how he believes that Karzai's election was not legal and that Karzai's government is not legitimate. So you basically, you're stuck with Karzai, but you don't have an election that is viewed as legitimate by everybody. You sort of have a cloud over it. And so I think what the Obama administration is trying to do is to say, okay, Karzai, let's see you do some work on corruption. Let's see you prove to us that your government can actually deliver the services that people are demanding. And Karzai does have some good ministers in some ministries that are very well respected, but the corruption and this election have just overshadowed all of the good work that those people have done.
Okay, here's an email from Rita in Washington, D.C., who writes to us about the election. She asks, do your panelists agree that this cancellation of the elections was organized by the White House during Kerry's visit to Kabul? The elections would have served to showcase the power of the Taliban to disrupt, and the West thought it best to stop them. But how unprincipled for the same folks who were saying Karzai was not credible to then congratulate him in the next breath. James Kitfield.
Well, it's an interesting point, and a lot of us have wondered what was going on behind the scenes. We've since learned that Abdullah himself was trying to cut a deal where he would get a certain number of ministry positions. When Karzai sort of balked at that, he pulled out of the election. I think that we were pressing Karzai to hold the runoff elections. I mean, in Afghanistan, much like the Pakistan and the whole region, you never get the optimum thing happening. It's always, is it better than the worst thing happening? In this case, I actually think this was better than the worst thing happening. The worst thing would have happened was if you had a runoff election that was equally as fraudulent as the first election and another 6 to 8 weeks of dithering around about what to do about it. In this case, actually, I think it worked to our advantage to have the matter settled. I think we thought that Karzai was going to win the runoff anyway, and now they have clearly got a plan to put the screws to him on this corruption deal. I had a chance to talk to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs this week, and he said publicly the strongest things I've heard about Karzai being on a very short leash to prove his bona fides on anti-corruption. They want to see some technocrats put in key positions in the government. They want to see some governors who are corrupt sacked. They want to see some people who are corrupt and involved in the drug trade arrested, and they want to see some anti-corruption reforms like an anti-corruption commission people have talked about, strengthening that. So I get the sense that there's a concerted effort, not just by us, but from Gordon Brown, from Britain, and all the allies, that Karzai has a brief window to show he's a workable partner here. And if he doesn't do it very quickly, they're going to start doing things that make his life uncomfortable.
Okay, I'm going to pick up on what you were saying there about Gordon Brown, because, of course, on Tuesday this week, 5 British soldiers were killed by an Afghan policeman who they'd been working with. The British soldiers had taken off their flak jackets. They were relaxing on a roof in the sun, and the policeman that they had been working with shot 5 of them dead. Today, Gordon Brown in London said, "I am not prepared to put the lives of British men and women in harm's way for a government that does not stand up against corruption." Paul Richter, how do you interpret the Prime Minister's comments?
Well, the deaths of the British soldiers earlier this week really put the burden back on the British government to explain why are we here. I mean, the British have lost nearly 100 soldiers this year. Things are going in the wrong direction. So Brown had to lay it out and explain why Britain is willing to put the lives of its men and women on the line especially for a leadership that seems so corrupt and inept. So he joined in the U.S. message on anti-corruption. He said, look, if Karzai is not going to shape up, we can't continue to go this way.
Farah, doesn't also what happened to those British soldiers underline the incredibly difficult task that the trainers have in training up a reliable Afghan military and a reliable Afghan police force?
It's very, very difficult. If you can't trust them, how can you train them? I mean, this happened to 2 American soldiers were killed in Maidan Shah, I believe, in Wardak about a month ago. I think you saw a similar situation in the past. And there are differing reports about this person who took the heavy machine gun and shot them. There are some reports that indicate he might have been on heroin. There's other reports that indicate that he quit and he was gone for a week and then he came back. But the real issue is that he went through the police academy. He was working with the police for 2 years and they trusted him.
The fact that they'd taken off their flak jackets and their body armor suggests they felt quite comfortable with this guy.
So the idea that, you know, the Taliban can infiltrate quite easily into this enterprise as you're trying to build up, you know, literally you know, hundreds of thousands of security forces, you're going to get some bad ones.
I was over in Afghanistan reporting on this very story last fall. And, you know, and that it does point to the fact that, you know, we've seen the goal for how quickly to build the Afghan security forces really rise exponentially. It was 134,000, then 200,000. They want to go beyond that to 300,000 plus. And, you know, they told me quite frankly, you know, if you're doing it that fast, you're going to the chances of missing someone in your vetting process really grow exponentially. They told me about a case where they had equipped some of the police with arms that were then found to be used in the assassination attempt on Hamid Karzai. So it does point to the opportunity that was lost when we could have been building this force for a long time. Now we're in this hurry-up mode because everyone understands there's a window here which is closing pretty quickly, and we've really got that, you know, the ticket out of there is to hand this off to Afghan security forces that can take these responsibilities just like we're doing in Iraq. And we're starting from a very late stage, and so we're having to do it in a very hurried state. The problem is there are no other options. You know, if there's no indigenous security force to keep al-Qaeda from reestablishing sanctuaries and keep the Taliban from reestablishing power, then it would be very hard for us to withdraw.
And James, of course, you also did an interview earlier with the governor of Anbar province in Iraq, talking about the kinds of lessons that could be learned from southern Iraq for Afghanistan. Tell us about that interview.
Well, I mean, it's a question on everyone's mind. You know, will the Anbar model work? Can you get a sort of a tipping point where the tribal leaders choose your side versus the side of the insurgents? And and a couple of things that I would point out from that conversation is it's very unlikely to happen as long as the insurgents seem to be winning and we seem to be losing, because it's hard. Not a lot of people want to pick the side of the loser. You know, the Anbar model happened right when we surged 30,000 new troops, and President Bush was saying very strong things about our continued commitment to Iraq. That was one thing. And the second thing was, you know, we put a lot of those sons of Iraq on our payroll. We used what they call SERP funds to bring in wells and irrigation ditches and development projects, the whole clear, hold, and build counterinsurgency. And he said that once you give people something that they value, something that they is worth fighting for, then they'll fight for you. And I think that is General McChrystal's strategy in Afghanistan. But you have to first establish security, as we just said. And second, you have to have either the government or the international community or the American military come in there and give them something that makes them want to side with you because you've made their lives better.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. We can speak to Mike in Toledo, Ohio. Mike, you have joined the Diane Rehm Show. Thank you for joining the program. Mike, are you there? I don't think we do have Mike. Okay, let's go to Mike. If you want to call back, please do try. Let's go to Dee in Viewtown, Virginia. Dee, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show. I think we seem to have a problem with our phones coming in at the moment, so we'll carry on our discussion here. We have an email that has come in talking about the events in Iran from Hillary in Washington, D.C. Hillary writes to us, how might the current events in Iran impact the situation of the three American hikers being detained in Iran and their chances for release? Can any of you comment on that?
You know, if we've seen in the past, these people are used as hostages and pawns. And as long as the situation is undecided, it's unlikely you'll see a release. But if there is a hopeful sign, if Iran decides, for instance, that it wants to reach an accommodation with the international community for a while, it might want to send a signal of that and release them. So, you know, I'm hopeful that they'll be used as pawns, like some journalists in the past and released.
Okay, let's go to Avi in Bethesda, Maryland. Avi, I think the phones are working now. You've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thanks for having me. I wanted to make a comment about Iran, and I think it's a little bit giving them too much credit, thinking that they are really struggling with their identity right now. I really think that they're continuing the same tactics of playing with the West and waiting and giving themselves more time to develop what we all know they're developing, which is a nuclear weapons program. I also heard about The Guardian having published a report today saying that they've been testing a missile with a capability to carry a nuclear head. All these signs, everything that's happening in Iran just indicates that they're very, very determined to develop their nuclear program. And I think the West needs to take further steps and not give them the time that they're trying to get to make progress on that program.
Okay, let's go to Farah Stockman.
Well, when I talked about deciding or struggling with its identity, I think that a lot of people look at Iran and they see it as entering a new stage right now. In the past, I think people saw that the Iranian revolutionary government had at least the veneer of legitimacy to a lot of Iranian people because it had this facade of democracy, and people thought it held water to a lot of people. And I think that now people are starting, both inside and outside Iran, starting to see it as more of a naked military dictatorship. And you're hearing reports about the Quds force reorganizing to kind of attack the enemy from within. And at the same time, you're also seeing some senior Iranian clerics say no and actually stand up and say that the taking of the American embassy, for instance, was a mistake. You had a senior Iranian cleric say that this week. So I think you're now seeing, I guess, a rift between those who want to consolidate this military kind of power and those who want to change direction. And so in the past, we've always thought from the outside that debate was going on, but we could never tell who was on which side. And now I think we're starting to see that much more starkly.
Paul Richter.
Yes, the Iranians are past masters of delay, the use of delay in diplomacy. And they have reason to believe that time is on their side here. But it does seem clear from the cacophony of voices about this issue of whether they should go with this nuclear deal that there are wide differences among them, and that this issue is simply not settled.
Okay, I want to go back a little bit to Iraq. We spoke about it briefly with James Kitfield a second ago, but there's been quite a lot of different developments in Iraq this week. On the one hand, we have the Iraqi parliament, which failed again this week to approve a law regulating its January election. Paul, do you think this election is going to take place?
It sounds like it could be delayed, but I noticed some Iraqis, legislators were telling the press, well, maybe it'll only be delayed slightly. On the other hand, they've been debating this election law for some time, and it has serious consequences for the U.S. if they don't get this settled because, of course, the White House and the Pentagon are thinking about drawing down those troops further. We need more in Afghanistan, probably.
And at the same time, we have Iraq signing deals to develop its oil fields. There was news this morning in the Washington Post that Exxon and Shell are going to sign a deal with the Iraqi oil ministry as well. So sort of some good news on the economic front, perhaps, James.
Well, there's some good news, but and why we're so interested in getting these elections behind Iraq so they can then get back to the major issues of reconciliation that are outstanding. And one is an oil law. You know, the Kurds are already signing deals, you know, independently of the central government. That's a potential fault line for division in
Iraq.
And,
of course, the hitch behind signing the current election law is over Kirkuk, which is a
right.
big oil.
Right. There is concern among the, you know, ever since Saddam has been ousted, he had sort of flooded Arabs into Kirkuk area. Since he's been ousted, a lot of the Kurds have been pushing more people into Kirkuk. So there's concerns in that tension between the Arabs and the Kurds that the election will sort of give one side an advantage over the other. And so that's been the sticking point. But I'll take Paul's point a little further. You know, I suspect there's going to be a surge of some tens of thousands of troops to Afghanistan, even though Obama hasn't announced that yet. I suspect he will. For that to happen, we have a very aggressive withdrawal schedule from Iraq next year, from 115,000 to just 50,000 by the end of August. That's super aggressive. They can't start that until after the elections because they want to have as many troops as possible to stop the violence we've seen even recently that the insurgents will try to use to delegitimize the elections. So as long as the longer this thing is delayed, the more complicated it gets for our military, which is extremely strained to do what it's going to need to do in Afghanistan. So I've talked to senior U.S. military leaders. They're very concerned about this thing getting dragged out for weeks, let alone months.
Give us a quick update, Farah, on the security situation in Baghdad following, of course, last week's truck bombings. Have you heard anything about how security has been changed or boosted? Have they reinstated some of the barriers in the streets, for example, in the Green Zone?
I just think we're hearing a lot of reports about bombings. It's not looking good. It's not looking good. But I think James might have a better update than I do.
What I would say about that, and again, this goes back to my interview with Admiral Mullen this week, was taking down the barriers was a controversial move. It played well domestically in domestic politics, but from a security standpoint, it was a risky move, and we've seen what's happened. The risk was that these truck bombs, with very powerful bombs, can get close to government ministries, ignite themselves, and they took out three major government buildings. So it does raise concerns as we pull out, as I said, next year, whether the Iraqi security services will be ready. The one bright line that was about that was, I mean, it was clearly designed to set off sectarian response from the Shiites, and it didn't happen. And that counts for good news in Iraq.
James Kitfield is the senior correspondent with National Journal. Farah Stockman is here. Paul Richter is here. We're going to take a quick break. Stay listening.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
A rubber ducky, you're the one.
On the next Fresh Air, to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Sesame Street, we listen back to an interview with the late Jeff Moss. That's him singing. He wrote many of the show's best-known songs and created Cookie Monster and Oscar the Grouch. Also, Chris Cerf will talk about songs he wrote for the show. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
When I make my way to the tubby, I find a little fellow who's cute and yellow and chubby.
Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kaye of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our Friday news roundup for our hour on international politics. I want to go to an email that came in on Israel while we're in the break from Terry, who writes to us, please explain why, when Israel doesn't do what we want, we don't just threaten them with cutting aid. It looks like we have no spine because we don't. We give them billions and supposedly want them to halt settlement. How hard is it to say, halt the settlements, or we won't give you this much, Paul Richter?
Well, there are certain limited things that the U.S. government thinks about doing to try to ratchet up the pressure on Israel a little bit. They can slow down military technology transfers, things of that sort. But the U.S. view is that Israel is one of our closest, most reliable allies in the Middle East. And, of course, there would be huge political consequences for any White House that went down too hard on them, as George H.W. Bush learned during his term when he thought about suspending loan guarantees for housing in Israel.
Let's go to the phones, to Dimitri in St. Louis, Missouri. Dimitri, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I want to discuss the Israeli-Palestinian issue. It seems to me that I'm Albanian, and I've seen how the UN has successfully modified the problems in Kosovo, where Serbians and ethnic Albanians are learning to live side by side. My question to the panel is, I'm curious why our government hasn't decided to go and use that as a model for resolving the problems between Israel and the Palestinians. And it works in Kosovo, and perhaps it might work there, and we could have peace in the Middle East. And that's my question to your panel, and thank you very much.
Interesting question, Dimitri. James Kitfield.
Well, I mean, the UN is involved in the region. We have UN looking at aid to the Palestinian refugees, et cetera. But as far as leading the negotiations, the Israelis don't trust the United Nations as an interlocutor. There's been a number of resolutions that are very anti-Israeli that a lot of the Arab and third world countries have proposed. We always veto those in the Security Council. So basically, for Israel, it's a non-starter. It's why America really, we saw that during the Bush administration when they tried to sort of step back from being the interlocutor and sort of just sided with Israel. We are the only possible interlocutor because the Israelis trust us. On the other hand, we also have the power to back up whatever deals are done. So the Palestinians look to us also. It's a difficult position to be in, but I don't think there's any substitute for it.
Okay, let's just talk about one other story this week. The conviction in Italy of 23 Americans on charges of kidnapping a Muslim cleric off the streets of Milan in 2003. Of course, this all linked to the policy of extraordinary rendition in the war on terror. Paul Richter, are the Italians ever going to get any of these people?
Well, the Italian government didn't like this trial to begin with and kept trying to reel the prosecutors back in. So it sounds like the chances are probably not that great. On the other hand, if I were these CIA agents, I'd cancel my Italian vacation this summer.
The U.S. has refused to extradite them. And so, but nonetheless, their lives are changed forever. I mean, they can't go to Europe. One of them has launched, their names are out there too. And one of them had a villa in Italy and he wanted to retire there and he can't. And another one put a lawsuit in asking the U.S. government to give her diplomatic immunity. And so this has caused quite an issue inside the U.S. government because these agents feel they've been left out there hanging, while the people who made the policy are not actually paying the price.
Which gets to the nub, of course, of the whole debate about torture and interrogation tactics. Farah, are there any other cases like this pending?
I think this is not the only rendition case in the world, but this is the first time that a trial has come to fruition like this. I think you could see other legal action elsewhere in the world.
And Paul, is the policy still going on? It is, isn't it, the policy of rendition? The Obama administration has not abandoned that policy.
That's right, although President Obama has said that he's forbidden any use of torture in these circumstances.
But the policy of actually transporting people to other countries is still happening.
They have not ruled it out, so we can assume it's going on.
I would just add to that, I mean, this policy was actually started in the Clinton administration. And, you know, along with all of our detention policies now, I think this case has done has shined a light that probably needed to be shined about, you know, these extraordinary renditions, because this person who was snatched off the street and sent to Egypt and reportedly tortured, just like the Canadian who was snatched from JFK and sent to Syria and reportedly tortured, neither one of them were ever charged with anything. They were eventually set free. And, you know, it is extrajudicial. Now, America may try to get some sort of deals cut around the world like they did with the criminal court and U.S. service members to exempt us from that. I'm not sure the world's in a mood to grant such exemptions, but it certainly does beg the question, is under international law, is this allowed?
It's also unclear to what extent the Italian government actually knew this was happening, that this cleric was under surveillance by Italians at the time when he was snatched. And, you know, who knows how much the higher-ups in Italy approved this, knew it was happening. And it just happens that the prosecutors in Italy are very independent, and they could make a political case on this, and they could actually stand up against their government and highlight this in a way their government didn't want.
They actually also convicted four Italian Secret Service people. So the Italians at some pretty high level actually knew about this. And as she says, the Italian courts are very independent of the Italian government.
Let's go to Dee in Viewtown, Virginia. Dee, you have this time really joined the Diane Rehm Show. Thanks for calling back.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. My question comment relates to the administration's deliberations on the mission in Afghanistan. And I had two notions. The comment is one that I think that we can rely on, or we should. I've not heard anybody talk about the notion of the mission being a punitive mission, in the sense that there are particularly perhaps tribes that were more involved in the alliance with al-Qaeda or hosting them than I've ever heard. I've never really heard which tribes are involved with the Pashtuns. And I was wondering if the mission could be simplified to dealing with those specific tribes. And Pashtun society, I know, has a tradition of hospitality that brought in these foreign elements. But there is also a strong concept of reciprocity that I think many Pashtuns would understand, that certain tribes played host to elements that were pretty much bad guests. And the what happens when that occurs is that the United States and the international world comes back because of what these guests did. And I don't understand why this has not been brought up as possibly a nature of the mission.
Okay, Dee, that's a very interesting question. I think it gets to a broader question as well about to what extent there is the prospect of some sort of negotiated settlement in Afghanistan. If we are now looking at the possibility that a military victory, an outright military victory, and Jeffersonian democracy is looking increasingly difficult to install with our forces there, are there discussions going in the White House about the prospect of negotiating with some of the tribes? James, of course, you were down in Anbar province where we did a similar thing. We had the surge, but to a large extent, it was our negotiations with the Sons of Iraq that actually produced an improvement in security.
Absolutely. A couple of points on that. I mean, that is part of McChrystal's strategy. He wants to peel off as many of the reconcilable, they call them, elements of the Taliban as they can, the tribal leaders who might be willing. As I said, until you look like you're winning this struggle or at least committed to it in a way that you will succeed, it's hard to get that tipping point where they're willing to side with you. Second point. Karzai has been seen as being insufficient supportive of this. I think it's one of the things they'll be looking at him to do is to be more assertive in trying to reach deals with tribal leaders who can be reconciled. And third, there is there's been no light that we've been able to see between Mullah Omar, who is the head of the Afghan Taliban, and al-Qaeda. So, and they were very close before 2011. They've remained close from everything we've seen. So the idea that we can peel off all of the support al-Qaeda has is probably not realistic. They're around Mullah Omar, what they call the Quetta Shura, there is pretty close ties with al-Qaeda.
Okay, we have Brian calling from Michigan. I'm going to get to you in a second, Brian. You were asking about the Global Warming Summit. I want to ask about that too. Of course, we had Angela Merkel in Washington this week urging action from Congress on the issue. The UN Climate Change Summit is just, I think, 4 weeks away. Paul Richter, what was Merkel saying? How much pressure are the Americans under to have more concerted action before Copenhagen?
Well, the Europeans have been trying to put a lot of pressure on the U.S. We want to talk about Afghanistan. They want to talk about climate change. And the chancellor gave a powerful speech on this subject. But the American Congress is divided. The Democrats are divided. The Republicans are mostly against this idea. One interesting thing that happened this week was three senators, Kerry, Lieberman, and Graham, got together and started talking about their own initiative, which interestingly would add to the legislation some concessions from environmentalists on nuclear energy and drilling in the Gulf. So in other words, the idea is perhaps they could peel away some Republicans by being more open to nuclear energy and drilling in the Gulf. Now, the environmentalists are already screaming about this, but it's an interesting look into which way this debate is moving.
Okay, let's go to Brian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You have a question about the Copenhagen summit. You've joined the program.
Well, you guys pretty much touched on the current things, but just trying to find out where the U.S. Senate is on the bills pending and how well, if they will have a bill to take with them to Copenhagen.
Well, Kerry passed a cap and trade bill out of this the committee this week, but I think it's still an open question whether whether that bill will look much like what it will look like in the end. And it's significant because not a single Republican actually showed up to vote in the committee. They just left the table empty. And so, you know, it's going to be a tough sell.
Meanwhile, Angela Merkel, she was in town this week. She was addressing Congress. What did she have to say on the subject?
She said, "We all know we have no time to lose." And this was at her joint address. And Democrats gave her a standing ovation, and some Republicans refused to stand up. So it's going to be an uphill battle.
And we've had some of the countries this week who are suffering some of the effects, particularly some of the poorer countries in Africa, saying, look, looking at the European Union, in fact, and saying, look, you are not pushing ahead fast enough on this. Our concerns are not being taken into account. It seems to me that heading into Copenhagen, we are a long way from some kind of global position, some unified global position on how to address this issue.
Without question. In fact, I saw reports that Senator Kerry has said there will be no legally binding treaty ready for Copenhagen. The administration's point man on climate change said the same thing. There will be no bill. It's kind of unfortunate that Merkel, you know, made her big pitch and has to hear this message. But the fact there's a couple things playing here. One of which is these things are difficult at the best of times. They're almost impossible when the economic situation is what it is. And secondly, it shows the Obama administration has really embraced, I think, people starting to understand, too ambitious of an agenda for his first year. He's in the midst of health care. He's in the midst of this huge, momentous decision on Afghanistan. And now he's supposed to have a treaty ready for Copenhagen in December on one of the most contentious issues that the Congress has ever taken up. The Republicans, as Paul said, are united against this. The Democrats are divided. So we're starting to see some of the wind that was at Obama's back through the summer, I think, start to dissipate.
I'm Cathy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wmu.org for our questions for the international hour of the news roundup. Let's go back to the phones now to Sam in Falls Church, Virginia. Sam, you've joined the program.
Yes, good morning to you and your guest. And I had a question regarding the misrepresentation and the misunderstanding about Iran, that so far, based on what I heard about your so-called panelists, really they are missing the big picture. Means they don't have the fundamental understanding about the Iran and Iranian culture. And
Sam, I'm going to stop you there because I'm very happy for you to call into the program with any question that you might have for my panelists. But I think if you call in by disrespecting them from the beginning, it's probably not going to add to the quality of our debate here. Let's go to Nancy in Arlington, Virginia. Nancy, you've joined the Diane Rehm Pro.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I want to get back to that Israel question again. Everybody says that Israel is our strongest ally in the Middle East, and that's why we capitulate to them so much. I really just don't get it, because for years they have been illegally occupying and restricting the free rights of the Palestinians. And why do we put up with it? And as one of your panelists said, look what happened to George H.W. Bush. It's almost extortionist to me that we let another country do this, a very wealthy country that probably has its own weaponry to fight, and we aid and assist them so much. I find it unconscionable.
Okay, Nancy, we just have a couple of minutes left on the program. Farah Stockman is going to take your question.
Well, I just want to say that there are people who do believe that the U.S. has not been willing to use its leverage on Israel, and that it should be willing. And I think that's an opinion that's growing both inside and outside of the administration. I think you've seen some baby steps towards actually tougher language towards Israel than we've had since Carter. But and there are some organizations that are coming up that say, look, we're pro-Israel, but we're also pro-peace. We believe that Israelis and Palestinians can live together, and we believe in order to do that, we need to push Israel, because we believe peace is actually in Israel's interest. We believe that a continuous state of war is not in Israel's interest, and because if you don't have a two-state solution, what do you got? You have a whole lot of Palestinians who have to become Israeli citizens, and Israel doesn't want that either.
James Kipfield, you get the last word on this. You're nodding your head.
I've heard this described from Israelis as when we side with Israel, it's the friends don't let friends drive drunk thing. we have to put pressure on both sides of this if we're going to find an agreement. And the degree that we are seen as siding constantly with one side or the other, it doesn't help our position as a mediator.
Okay, James Kitfield is senior correspondent for National Journal magazine. Farah Stockman has been with me as well. She's foreign affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. Paul Richter has also been here, diplomatic correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you all so much for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. You've been listening to our Friday news roundup. I've been sitting in for Diane Rehm, who is on a cruise with NPR listeners. Thank you so much for listening, all of you, and have a great weekend.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.